Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
This is another wake-up call that we are in a new era of authoritarian aggression led by the dictators in China and Russia.
Senator Dan Sullivan warns of alleged Chinese spies on Alaska military bases. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, June 7th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Anchorage's summer clearing of homeless camps starts at a park set for an upcoming music festival.
These are people who literally have nowhere to go, and the courts have said you can't punish them for sleeping in a park when there are no other options that you have for them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska is growing quickly, so construction jobs are in high demand. 1 in 20 jobs in Alaska are in construction, and with the industry expanding every year, Alaska needs a bigger workforce. The University of Alaska system offers accessible construction management programs, giving students the skills they need to empower Alaska. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan says Chinese nationals in Fairbanks posing as tourists drove through Fort Wainwright's main gate and onto the post before being stopped by security personnel. Sullivan said that and other incidents in recent years show that both China and Russia are trying to collect information on Alaska military installations and operations. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Sullivan issued a statement about the Fort Wainwright Gate incident last week, on the same day that USA Today published a story about it. The senator says the incident fits a pattern set by flights of a Chinese surveillance balloon over Alaska and Russian aircraft formations offshore.
Whether it's a Chinese spy balloon, Russian bear bombers, or this new reporting of suspected Chinese spies in Alaska, this is another wake-up call that we are in a new era of authoritarian aggression led by the dictators in China and Russia.
An 11th Airborne Division spokesperson referred questions about the incident to Fort Wainwright, which in turn referred all queries to the Defense Department, which also declined to comment, and so did the FBI. Sullivan spokesperson Ben Dietrich would only confirm the incident occurred and that it's not the first time it's happened.
We've been aware of incidents similar to this. And the specific one mentioned, the senator's been briefed on that.
The May 31st USA Today story says a car full of Chinese nationals, quote, blew through a Fort Wainwright security checkpoint and was later stopped on post. The story says authorities found a drone aircraft inside the vehicle, and it says U.S. officials suspect the incident is part of an effort by China to learn more about Alaska military installations and their operations by using Chinese nationals posing as tourists. Sullivan says he's looking into the allegations.
I am pressing for more details on these alleged security breaches and will continue to work with the Department of Defense to ensure our installations in Alaska remain secure.
Well, it's always a threat for sure. That's always been happening.
Troy Bouffard directs the University of Alaska Fairbanks' Center for Arctic Security and Resilience. The 22-year Army veteran and doctoral student says it's not surprising that adversaries are interested in the U.S. military buildup in Alaska and its role in maintaining U.S. national interests in the Indo-Pacific region.
So nothing too new there. We definitely have adversaries who are probably increasing their efforts to gain knowledge and intel.
Bouffard agrees with Sullivan that Alaska has a lot of military assets of great interest to U.S. adversaries, including its ground-based missile defense system, advanced jet fighters, and a rapidly deployable Army Expeditionary Force.
With the 11th Airborne Division being reactivated, there's a lot of interest from our adversaries on, like, what kind of capabilities are they developing.
But the head of a Fairbanks-based tourism marketing organization has another theory about the Fort Wainwright incident that's based on an increasing number of Chinese students enrolled in lower 48 universities coming to Alaska to visit.
Fairbanks has been a popular spring break destination for them to come here and, you know, experience all the winter activities that we have to offer.
Explore Fairbanks president and CEO Scott McCray says he recalls an incident that occurred a few years ago when some Chinese students looking for the North Star Burroughs Birch Hill Recreation Area off the Steese Expressway instead ended up at Fort Wainwright's Birch Hill Ski and Snowboard Area.
And apparently, Google Maps directs them to the Birch Hill on the Fort Wainwright side. Nothing nefarious beyond that.
In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
A park in Midtown Anchorage has become a focal point in the city's response to homelessness this summer. Mayor Dave Bronson's administration is in the process of clearing campers out of the park in the name of public safety ahead of a multi-day music festival. The Anchorage Assembly just pushed to allow camping next to the park, but after the festival. And at the same time, civil rights lawyers are fighting to let campers stay put. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports.
Anchorage city workers are loading debris and bag after bag of garbage onto flatbed trucks at a shrinking homeless encampment. After the city closed its winter shelters last month, dozens of tents popped up in this vacant, city-owned lot next to Cuddy Family Midtown Park. The city posted notices a couple of weeks ago saying it planned to clear campsites out of the area. Many campers have already left, but Kyla Friedenblum will be among the last to go. She and her companions have a wheelbarrow and shopping carts loaded up with stuff near their campsite. There are waist-high stacks of plastic bins, piles of tote bags and backpacks, and rolled canvases. A little dog named Thor hops on top of one pile to keep watch.
This is our house, you know.
Friedenblum has been camping in this spot for months, well before the number of campers swelled.
And you want us out for a concert, and then we can come back. It's supposed to turn into a sanctioned area, so don't get it. But it's politics, and, you know, that's just the way it goes. But I'm hanging in there. I'm in better spirits than I thought I would be.
She had a medical scare recently and was in the hospital over the long Memorial Day weekend.
We're the lepers, you know.
That's Marcus Salazar, an easygoing, curly-haired 20-something.
They don't want the rich people seeing all the homeless people, so, I mean, it is what it is, you know. I understand that you're coming to spend money, but it's not like, you know, we all have disease, or, you know. So it's a little messed up, but...
Last fall, a local concert production business decided to host a multi-day outdoor music festival in the park. They paid for permits, lined up nearly 100 artists, invested about $1 million into the event, and sold thousands of tickets. Then this spring, the city shut down its winter homeless shelters, leaving hundreds of people without a reliable roof over their heads. That sent them into the streets, green spaces, and vacant lots, including the concert venue. Helen Fleming is part owner of the concert production business Showdown Alaska. It's putting on the Sundown Solstice Festival in the park June 16th to 18th. In 10 years of business, she says this is the first time an issue like this has come up.
I felt that blame got dumped on us.
Fleming is sympathetic to the campers, but said she trusted city officials to make the best decision for everyone. Mayor Bronson's lead on homelessness issues and the head of the Parks and Recreation Department have said they decided to clear the camps in and around Cuddy Park because the combination of campers, thousands of concertgoers, alcohol, and vehicle traffic created a unique public safety situation.
It's tough because we're, you know, being painted a little bit into a corner when our only intent was to just do something really nice for the city to help, you know, economic growth and bring something special.
Fleming wonders why the city closed its winter shelters without a plan and why there wasn't better communication about the concert conflict before campers settled in. That conflict may not actually be resolved. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska is stepping in to provide campers with legal help. Ruth Botstein is the nonprofit's legal director.
These are people who literally have nowhere to go, and the courts have said you can't punish them for sleeping in a park when there are no other options that you have for them.
She says the organization filed notices with the city on Monday that it will appeal the forced relocation of 13 people who are or were living in and around Cuddy Park.
You know, the city has made a conscious values and policy choice not to provide shelter for people, and, you know, that might mean that it is harder to maximize revenue for renting out the parks for other purposes. That is a consequence of the choices the city has made.
She says those appeals will be filed in Anchorage Superior Court in the coming days. The mayor's office could not immediately be reached for comment about the appeals. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
The Anchorage Assembly has recommended allowing the city-owned lot next to Cuddy Park to be used as a camp for homeless residents. The lot was one of five sites across Anchorage that a city task force recommended in May. Mayor Dave Bronson noted that the city will use the term allowed camp as opposed to sanctioned camp to reduce potential legal liability. An earlier version of the resolution would have recommended the use of all five sites, but at the Assembly's meeting last night, member Felix Rivera introduced a new one that focuses on standing up one initial site, which is in Rivera's district.
This site is really a pilot. That's how folks should think about it, to see what works, what doesn't work. So come summer of 2024, and really much sooner than that, but by the time we get to summer of 2024, we are in a better position to consider our decisions on allowed camps.
The resolution recommends that the lot allow between 30 and 60 people to stay there starting on July 17th. It doesn't create any policy or allocate any money to the proposal. Mayor Bronson says he supports the idea, but he says it will take some sort of city funding.
I support this, but we got to look at the money now.
Meanwhile, the Assembly postponed a vote on putting between $7 million and $11 million toward the construction of a homeless shelter and navigation center in East Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Alaska Pacific University is reimagining how to train nurses in rural Alaska.
If there's one thing I've realized since living in Alaska for the last, 12 years now, it's that you have to pretty much grow your own.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by SNAP.
Alaska Pacific University got a nearly $3 million grant from the Department of Labor to help diversify and expand the state's nurse workforce. The university partnered with Bethel's Utliknavik and the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation on a licensed practical nursing program. As KYUK's Sunny Bean reports, nine students have graduated so far, and the partners are aiming to improve health outcomes in rural Alaska.
The new nursing program is rigorous, and many students have to travel for hours on snowmobiles or take multiple flights to get to clinicals and exams.
They have families, they have lives, they have jobs, they have a lot of things, a lot of responsibilities.
That's Mary Ann Murray, director and professor of nursing at Alaska Pacific University. A lot of things about this program are non-traditional. For example, the majority of nurses in the U.S. are white women, but not in this program. Diane Droutman, the coordinator of the LPN program, says the scheduling is different, too. She and their Bethel-based partner at the Elder House designed a one-week on and one-week off schedule to be flexible for life on the YK Delta.
And she was like, we can do that? And I went, we're starting the program. We can do whatever we want.
They also split up the program so students can build credentials incrementally. Instead of completing a 3 to 4 year program in one go, students can start with their certified nursing assistant degree. A 6 to 9 week program. Then they can work. Then they can go back to the next degree. The initiative is a response to Alaska's nursing shortage. A study by the National Center for Health Workforce Analysis projects Alaska will have the highest number of nursing vacancies in 2030, with almost a quarter of positions left unfilled.
If there's one thing I've realized since living in Alaska for the last, 12 years now, it's that you have to pretty much grow your own, especially if you want people to stay.
Murray says there's a roadmap to building a homegrown Alaskan nursing corps.
The way that we increase the number of nursing students is through increasing faculty as well as increasing partnerships so that we have access to those clinical environments where we can teach our students.
The Department of Labor grant is intended to educate a more diverse range of nurses to improve rural and tribal health care. They have a holistic admissions process that considers a person's community and what they'll give back to it. The program costs more than $30,000, a high price tag, though that includes living expenses, books, and tuition.
The good thing is, because of our tribal affiliation, there is huge scholarship opportunities for students that both work in the tribal healthcare system, and then any of those students that have Indigenous or Alaska Native heritage.
APU also wants to teach cultural safety, a framework developed for health equity for Native people in New Zealand. Here's Droughtman again.
One of the big tenets of the culturally safe healthcare is removing that power level, like the doctor has all the power, because the patients know what their life is like. They know what they can and can't do. So we need to work with the patients to find out the best way for them to manage what's going on in their life.
They also talk to nurses about power structures they may not realize they're perpetuating. They talk about implicit bias, stereotypes, and the historic dynamics contributing to healthcare inequity. They do exercises where the students write down what they think of when they hear bad patient. Droughtman described one patient's journey that opened her eyes to why it's so important to have local facilities.
He had a gunshot wound, and he had to take, when he got to the closest village, they didn't have a healthcare worker, so they had to send him to the next one. So they had a dog sled, so they took him by dog sled to that village. He then had a snow machine to the next village, who put him on a float plane to the clinic, who said, oh, you need a little bit more, put him on a plane to Bethel. Bethel said he needed more care, so they put him on a plane to Fairbanks. And then Fairbanks said, you know, he really needs a specialist because it was in his foot and they didn't want him to lose mobility and more use of that foot. So they sent him to Anchorage.
It took 30 hours to get him from a village to Anchorage. It's challenging for APU to operate in the bush. At times, they have classes with no water and can't wash their hands during clinicals. There have been times when students are online with faculty or taking an exam and the internet drops. Plus, internet service is expensive, so they decide to make sure students have hard copy backups of every exam.
So they send out a printer. We're setting up the printer. We got it all set, and a plane goes over, and it stops working because it was a wireless one.
Program organizers are using the grant to make it easier for students to navigate issues. They're giving them thumb drives so they don't have to download their slides. And they're getting high-fidelity simulation mannequins, for which they're planning to record elders speaking in Yupik for simulations practicing overcoming language barriers. They're also teaching more culturally rooted medicinal practices for Native people. They talk about shaman and the use of plants and herbs for healing and health. Classes start up again in Bethel on August 21st. After their success in Bethel, three more hospitals reached out to establish partnerships. Over the next year, the program could expand to Anchorage, the Matsu Valley, and Juneau. Droughtman says her hope is patients will get a different experience with care when fellow Alaskans are focusing on their needs. In Bethel, I'm Sunny Bean.
People in Juneau who run Airbnbs or other short-term rentals are required to pay sales tax and hotel bed tax to the city. But as the number of rentals continues to go up, the city needs a way to keep track of who's paying and who is not. As KTOO's Katie Anastas reports, owners may soon have to register their short-term rentals with the city.
The registration program would assign a unique number to each short-term rental. Owners would have to include that number in their online listings. Deputy City Manager Robert Barr says it would help the city collect sales tax and have a clearer picture of the market.
And since most of those advertisements happen over online short-term rental platforms like Airbnb and VRBO, that enables us to have a more comprehensive understanding of short-term rental activity in Juneau.
The Assembly will vote on whether to create a registration program next week. They've already started discussing other ways they could curb the increase in short-term rentals, which can leave long-term renters with fewer, more expensive housing options. Other communities provide some examples. Sitka requires short-term rental owners to live on the property for half of the year. Wasilla issues just 75 short-term rental permits per year, and one property owner can have up to three permits. At a meeting on Monday, Juneau Assembly member Alicia Hughes-Gandies expressed interest in some of those measures.
I'd be interested to see what something like limiting it to your primary residence, limitations on the number that an individual could operate, even if we didn't have a borough-wide cap.
Member Wade Bryson urged the Assembly to be cautious.
I agree that we are going down a correct path. We need to register short-term rentals. We need to make sure that they're not literally displacing our residents. But I would like to remind everybody that we are about to begin on a process of telling people what they can do with their property. And that is a big deal.
Barr says the registration program likely won't yield useful data until it's been running for a year or more. But he told the Assembly it's a good first step in understanding the growing short-term rental market in Juneau.
As more people get into that particular market and business, regulation becomes more painful for more people the longer you wait to do it.
If approved, the registration program would begin in July. In Juneau, and Katie Anastas.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein online at lbblawyers.com. If you find yourself asking, what's next? The University of Alaska Anchorage can point you in the right direction. With over 100 fully accredited degree programs and certificates to choose from, plus resources to guide you through your academic experience, your future is in your hands. Whether you're starting over or taking your career to the next level, discover what's next at UAA. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Nome residents and brothers Oliver and Wilson Hogendorn competing as the AK Boys on USA Network's Race to Survive Alaska television series took home the championship on Monday during a watch party and in front of a packed hometown audience. KNOM's Ava White has the story.
After showcasing their win, which includes a $500,000 cash prize, in front of the standing room only crowd, they said this was the most challenging.
The most challenging aspect of the show was probably starving for like 50 days, 100%.
The Race to Survive Alaska aired starting in March of this year and showcased 8 teams embarking on a competition to survive the Alaskan wilderness. The brothers competed over the summer across the 50-day survival course, becoming the first winners of the show. The 8 teams of 2 competed in 6 races over 100 miles of Alaskan wilderness, including the Aleutian Islands. The brothers faced treacherous terrain and weather, but persevered and brought the win home to Nome. They said that they needed each other more than anything during the competition.
Absolutely necessary. With any other partner, it wouldn't have gone as well. So I'm glad we had each other.
If I didn't have a brother as a partner, probably wouldn't have won it.
The teams were only allowed to use what they could carry on their back and use their wildland skills to make it through each race. With their winnings, the pair says that they plan to give back to the Nome community and thanked numerous family members, friends, and supporters after the airing of the episode. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ava White.
Pouring rain did not stop a special ceremony honoring a one-of-a-kind canoe last week. Tribal members and Ketchikan residents gathered to awaken and launch a canoe designed by a late master carver and artist who called Ketchikan one of his homes. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, it was a joyous occasion full of tradition.
When I say Haigwa, you say Ah! Haigwa! Ah! Haigwa! Ah! Haigwa! Ah!
Dozens of people shout in the Haida language as they heave together, carrying the canoe to the water. The canoe has a fiberglass hull with wood underneath and is painted red, white, and black. A design of running salmon swirls around the canoe. When someone gets tired, another steps in. It's a show of teamwork and of strength.
So of all the people that are going to be holding the canoe, if anything feels unsafe or unsturdy, make sure you yell it out so everybody knows so we can fix it.
Earlier in the afternoon, a big crowd of tribal members and Ketchikan residents had gathered for an awakening ceremony. The canoe was designed by the late Marvin Oliver, Oliver owned Alaska Eagle Arts in downtown Ketchikan, but also had art installations around the world. He was a professor and a curator and had won an award for his work in diversity. Canoes run in the family. Oliver's father created the paddle to Seattle. Several speakers share their thoughts during the awakening part of the ceremony before the launching. They include Ketchikan Indian community staff and tribal members, and Oliver's family. His wife, Bridget Ellis, stands in front of her husband's creation alongside her family. She talks about respecting the canoe's place in Indigenous culture.
First thing I want to share with you is you never say the B word, okay? It's spelled B-O-A-T, but we don't say the B word. In traditional canoe culture, the canoe is always a canoe and never the B word. It is said if a paddler speaks of the vessel as a B word, that paddler will be thrown into the water. You learn really fast to call it a canoe at all times.
She says that Oliver felt connected to canoes because of his father's role in the paddle to Seattle and his Salish heritage.
The canoe revitalization will empower the youth. That's what he and I had in mind. To carry these important traditions forward. It's the canoe that fosters a healthy sense of identity among young Indigenous people. Those youth that struggle emotionally come together and say canoe culture is a life-changing event.
Oliver died in 2019, but the year before, the tribe's council bought the canoe. Tribe leaders say that the canoe and canoe journeys will advance the tribe's strategic plan, which focuses on uniting the community and spreading culture. Norman Scan is the Ketchikan Indian Community President.
We already have our dance, we have our arts, we have our subsistence food, and this is just another component of the wholeness that we are slowly becoming.
The canoe also receives its name. Brothers Richard and Willie Jackson named the canoe Hootskayak, or Brown Bear Spirit. Willie Jackson explains their choice.
He is your protector on this canoe. You guys ready? Hootskayak! Little louder. Hootskayak! Little louder. Hootskayak!
Before the canoe is carried into the water, there is drumming, singing, and an acknowledgement of the Indigenous people who have lived on the land since time immemorial. Adults lift up children and help them drape cedar boughs on the canoe. After the canoe is floating, the mood is joyous. There is dancing and singing. Some wear cedar hats and drum, and others dance in their soggy jeans and sneakers. In Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Sonny Bean in Bethel, Katie Anastas in Juneau, Ava White in Nome, and Reagan Miller in Ketchikan. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
And by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.